Where is this? Is Brian's mother here? Saying you better listen to the student around.
Commanded by a 38-year-old Marine Major James T.S. Devereaux. They sank one Japanese light cruiser and three destroyers.
Bloody radio, why doesn't this work? Trond, why doesn't this work?
I don't know, Hans, I don't know. I kind of fiddled a bit with it.
Yeah, you know, I can see that. What's the watch doing on top of it? I mean,
well,
I don't know why you're supposed to be like this. I mean,
it's not my fault. Technician is dead, you know? They took him out and shot him. Come
why?
On.
Oh, bloody war. I mean,
yeah. I don't
can't get news in, so we can't really know who's fighting who and who's doing what.
No. Ugh. But I know that they took our technician and they shot him dead.
That's. Oh.
But yeah. I don't know, how can they do this? It's just a couple of years since the last big war. Why can't they just leave us be?
Yeah, I don't know. Where did they get the money from? Yeah,
exactly.
Where did they get the resources to make the war? And although it's a good choice killing our technician, though. He was an asshole.
Yeah, he was really an asshole. And he always was talking about, yeah, you have to talk about podcast and internet. And yeah, and I hated it.
Yeah, I mean, what?
He couldn't make a good cup of coffee either.
No, but then, is our maid doing okay?
Hmm?
Our maid? I haven't seen her in a while.
No, but I don't think they wouldn't shoot a maid, I think.
Oh,
let's hope.
Well, who knows?
But I wished I had a newspaper since our radio isn't there, but we don't have a newspaper.
No, we use all the money on books.
Yeah, but that's a good investment, actually.
Yeah, it is. I would much rather have a book than a newspaper. I mean, the book contains so much more information.
Yeah, and also the quality. Come on. If it had been a newspaper from early 1920s, 1910, perhaps, then I would go for it, newspaper. But nowadays, newspapers are just...
No, rubbish.
Yeah, just rubbish. So, rather have books.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but it's really, really annoying to not know how the war is going. I mean, it would be rather nice to know if they were starting to bomb us tonight.
Yeah, let's hope not.
No, let's hope not.
So, but death, right? Interesting.
Yeah, death. It's an interesting subject. I'm a bit too close on the body right now, but...
I think it's quite okay, actually.
You're mad.
Yeah.
You're insane.
Yeah, I know. So... you ever heard about Sigmund Freud?
Yeah, he would also say something about insanity on you.
Hmm?
He would also say something about insanity and you and such things.
Yeah, he would probably don't like me very well, but he's dead. He died before the last war.
Which might be just as well, since he was a Jew.
Yeah, Jew descent. Same thing.
Before the bearded... No, did not bearded. The guy with the funny moustache. That's not very much of a difference, really.
No. So,
yeah, but he also had some reflections on war and death, didn't he?
Yeah, he wrote a small piece called Reflections on War and Death.
Yeah, I suppose that to suit our needs right now, so, well, let's give it a listen then.
Reflections on War and Death by Sigmund Freud. Our attitude towards death. It remains for us to consider the second factor of which I have already spoken, which accounts for our feeling of strangeness in a world which used to seem so beautiful and familiar to us. I refer to the disturbance in our former attitude towards death. Our attitude had not been a sincere one. To listen to us, we were, of course, prepared to maintain that death is the necessary termination of life, that every one of us owes nature his death, and must be prepared to pay his debt. In short, that death was natural, undeniable, and inevitable. In practice, we were accustomed to act as if matters were quite different. We have shown an unmistakable tendency to put death aside, to eliminate it from life. We have attempted to hush it up. In fact, we have the proverb, to think of something as of death. Of course, we meant our own death. We cannot indeed imagine our own death. Whenever we try to do so, we find that we survive ourselves as spectators. The school of psychoanalysis could thus assert that, at bottom, no one believes in his own death, which amounts to saying, in the unconscious, every one of us is convinced of his immortality. As far as the death of another person is concerned, every man of culture will studiously avoid mentioning this possibility in the presence of the person in question. Only children ignore this restraint. They boldly threaten each other with the possibility of death, and are quite capable of giving expression to the thought of death in relation to the persons they love. As, for instance, "Dear Mama, when unfortunately you are dead, I shall do so and so." The civilized adult also likes to avoid entertaining the thought of another's death, lest he seem harsh or unkind, unless his profession as a physician or a lawyer brings up the question. Least of all would he permit himself to think of somebody's death if this event is connected with a gain of freedom, wealth, or position. Death is, of course, not deferred through our sensitiveness on the subject. And when it occurs, we are always deeply affected, as if our expectations had been shattered. We regularly lay stress upon the unexpected causes of death. We speak of the accident, the infection, or advanced age, and thus betray our endeavor to debase death from a necessity to an accident. A large number of deaths seems unspeakably dreadful to us. We assume a special attitude towards the dead, something almost like admiration for one who has accomplished a very difficult feat. We suspend criticism of him, overlooking whatever wrongs he may have done, and issue the command, "De mortuis nil nisi bene." We act as if we were justified in singing his praises at the funeral oration, and inscribe only what is to his advantage on the tombstone. This consideration for the dead, which he really no longer needs, is more important to us than the truth, and to most of us, certainly, it is more important than consideration for the living. This conventional attitude of civilized people towards death is made still more striking by our complete collapse at the death of a person closely related to us, such as a parent, a wife or husband, a brother or sister, a child or a dear friend. We bury our hopes, our wishes, and our desires with the dead. We are inconsolable and refuse to replace our loss. We act in this case as if we belong to the tribe of the Asra, who also die when those whom they love perish. But this attitude of ours towards death exerts a powerful influence upon our lives. Life becomes impoverished and loses its interest when life itself, the highest stake in the game of living, must not be risked. It becomes as hollow and empty as an American flirtation in which it is understood from the beginning that nothing is to happen, in contrast to a continental love affair in which both partners must always bear in mind the serious consequences. Our emotional ties, the unbearable intensity of our grief, make us disinclined to court dangers for ourselves and those belonging to us. We do not dare to contemplate a number of undertakings that are dangerous, but really indispensable, such as aeroplane flights, expeditions to distant countries, and experiments with explosive substances. We are paralyzed by the thought of who is to replace the son to his mother, the husband to his wife, or the father to his children, should an accident occur. A number of other renunciations and exclusions result from this tendency to rule out death from the calculations of life. And yet, the motto of the Hanseatic League said, Navigare necesse est, vivere non necesse. It is necessary to sail the seas, but not to live. It is therefore inevitable that we should seek compensation for the loss of life in the world of fiction, in literature, and in the theater. There we still find people who know how to die, who are even quite capable of killing others. There alone the condition for reconciling ourselves to death is fulfilled. Namely, if beneath all the vicissitudes of life, a permanent life still remains to us. It is really too sad that it may happen in life as in chess, where a false move can force us to lose the game, but with this difference, that we cannot begin a return match. In the realm of fiction we find the many lives in one for which we crave. We die in identification with a certain hero, and yet we outlive him and, quite unharmed, are prepared to die again with the next hero.
J-E-L-L.
Extra, extra, extra good news. The makers of Jell-O have discovered a way to give you rich, luscious chocolate pudding far more easily and far more economically than ever before. With the new Jell-O chocolate pudding powder, you can make old-fashioned pudding, smooth, creamy, and chocolatey, just like the ones grandmother used to make back in the good old days. Now you can have them again, and this is all you have to do. Just combine the contents of a package of Jell-O chocolate pudding with some milk in the top of your double boiler, letting it cook until it becomes smooth and thick. When the mixture has cooled, serve it in sherbet glasses. You'll have enough for six helpings, and that means six happy people. Jell-O chocolate pudding is so simple, so inexpensive, and so downright delicious that you mustn't delay trying it. Ask your grocer for Jell-O chocolate pudding, and if he hasn't put it in stock yet, be sure he orders it for you. Remember the name, Jell-O chocolate pudding.
Hans?
Yeah?
Do you think we need chocolate pudding in the war?
Yes, most definitely not.
Well, but, you know, it's good to have something good to eat when life's fucked.
Yeah, we can check up the happiness. When six happy people during wartime buying chocolate pudding? I doubt it, but...
yeah, well,
it's an experiment.
Nice image.
It's an experiment.
Yeah, I know. Well, wait a second.
What is that? I told you should get the news fixed. I mean...
Is it a bomb? Not a bomb, but is it bombs?
Yeah, I think it is.
Listen. Oh, yeah. Yes, indeed. Yeah, that's it. Do you have some place we can go?
Yeah, just down the basement. Just come here. Okay. I don't... Here comes the alarm. Here it comes. Let's see. Just through the door over there.
Do you have keys?
Yeah, keys. Finally, here, keys. Aha. Opening the door here. Ah. Finally, the lock fixed.
Oh.
Yeah.
You're good. Nice lighting.
Yeah, it's quite nice here, actually. Lights and such. Yeah.
What a long way to go.
Unfortunately,
how deep is this thing?
Deep enough, let me tell you, deep enough. They'll take the house crashing down on us to kill us now. They'll drop a bomb straight at us.
Let's hope they don't do that then.
No, let's hope they don't do that.
Well, nice place you got here.
Yeah, it's nice enough, actually. It's quite good. Let's just sit down over there.
Yeah, let's... Can't be standing around dying. That would be kind of bad.
That would be ridiculous.
Yeah, really ridiculous.
Actually, I've managed quite well here. I haven't been down here after I finished it, though.
When did you finish it?
Last week.
That's good timing.
Yeah, that's really good timing.
I hope you got food.
Yeah, I got some food. As you can see, it's not exactly tidy.
Do you got books?
Yeah, I actually do. Yeah, it's a neat stack behind you there. If you can just take the top one.
Yeah.
That one, yeah.
Ah, Blackwood.
Yeah, Blackwood.
He's a good friend of ours.
He's a good friend of ours, yeah. It's about dying.
I don't know if that's a good topic right now.
Oh, well, it's the only thing I have down here.
Okay, then we can go for it.
This is probably the best, let me tell you. It's probably the best.
Oh, right, what is it?
Dance of Death.
Ah, I've heard about that one.
Yeah, it's good and it's nice. In a non-horror-y kind of way about death or something. Well, anyhow, let's play it before we get freaked out by these bombs.
The Dance of Death by Algernon Blackwood. Brown went to the dance feeling genuinely depressed, for the doctor had just warned him that his heart was weak and that he must be exceedingly careful in the matter of exertion. "Dancing?" he asked, with that assumed lightness some natures affect in the face of a severe shock, the plucky instinct to conceal pain. "Well, in moderation, perhaps," hummed the doctor. "Not wildly," he added, with a smile that betrayed something more than mere professional sympathy. At any other time, Brown would probably have laughed, but the doctor's serious manner put a touch of ice on the springs of laughter. At the age of 26, one hardly realizes death. Life is still endless, and it is only old people who have hearts and such like afflictions. So it was that the professional dictum came as a real shock, and with it, too, as a sudden revelation, came that little widening of sympathy for others that is part of every deep experience as the years roll up and pass. At first he thought of sending an excuse. He went about carefully, making the buses stop dead before he got out and going very slowly up steps. Then gradually he grew more accustomed to the burden of his dread secret, the commonplace events of the day, the hated drudgery of the office where he was an underpaid clerk, the contact with other men who bore similar afflictions with assumed indifference, the fault-finding of the manager, making him fearful of his position. All this helped to reduce the sense of first alarm, and instead of sending an excuse, he went to the dance, as we have seen, feeling deeply depressed, and moving all the time as if he carried in his side a brittle glass globe that the least jarring might break into a thousand pieces. The spontaneous jollity natural to a boy and girl dance served, however, to emphasize vividly the contrast of his own mood, and to make him very conscious again of his little hidden source of pain. But, though he would gladly have availed himself of a sympathetic ear among the many there whom he knew intimately, he nevertheless exercised the restraint natural to his character, and avoided any reference to the matter that bulked so largely in his consciousness. Once or twice he was tempted, but a prevision of the probable conversation that would ensue stopped him always in time. "Oh, I am so sorry, Mr. Brown, and you mustn't dance too hard, you know." And then his careless laugh as he remarked that it didn't matter a bit, and his little joke as he whirled his partner off for another spin. He knew, of course, there was nothing very sensational about being told that one's heart was weak. Even the doctor had smiled a little, and he now recalled more than one acquaintance who had the same trouble and made light of it. Yet it sounded in Brown's life a note of profound and sinister gloom. It snatched beyond his reach at one fell swoop all that he most loved and enjoyed, destroying a thousand dreams and painting the future a dull drab color without hope. He was an idealist at heart, hating the sordid routine of the life he led as a business underling. His dreams were of the open air, of mountains, forests, and great plains, of the sea, and of the lonely places of the world. Wind and rain spoke intimately to his soul, and the storms of heaven, as he heard them raging at night round his high room in Bloomsbury, stirred savage yearnings that haunted him for days afterwards with the voices of the desert. Sometimes during the lunch hour, when he escaped temporarily from the artificial light and close air of his high office stool, to see the white clouds sailing by overhead, and to hear the wind singing in the wires, it set such a fever in his blood that for the remainder of the afternoon he found it impossible to concentrate on his work, and thus exasperated the loud-voiced manager almost to madness. Having no expectations and absolutely no practical business ability, he was fortunate, however, in having a place at all, and the hard fact that promotion was unlikely made him all the more careful to keep his dreams in their place, to do his work as well as possible, and to save what little he could. His holidays were the only points of light in an otherwise dreary existence, and one day, when he should have saved enough, he looked forward vaguely to a life close to nature, perhaps a shepherd on 100 hills, a dweller in the woods, within sound of his beloved trees and waters, where the smell of the earth and campfire would be ever in his nostrils, and the running stream always ready to bear his boat swiftly away into happiness. And now the knowledge that he had a weak heart came to spoil everything. It shook his dream to the very foundations. It depressed him utterly. Any moment the blow might fall. It might catch him in the water swimming, or halfway up the mountain, or midway in one of his lonely tramps, just when his enjoyment depended most upon his being reckless and forgetful of bodily limitations, that freedom of the spirit in the wilderness he so loved. He might even be forced to spend his holiday, to say nothing of the dream of the far future, in some farmhouse, quietly, instead of gloriously in the untrodden wilds. The thought made him angry with pain. All day he was haunted and dismayed, and all day he heard the wind whispering among branches, and the water lapping somewhere against sandy banks in the sun. The dance was a small subscription affair, hastily arranged and happily informal. It took place in a large hall that was used in the daytime as a gymnasium, but the floor was good and the music more than good. Foils and helmets hung round the walls, and high up under the brown rafters were ropes, rings, and trapezes coiled away out of reach, their unsightliness further concealed by an array of brightly colored flags. Only the light was not of the best, for the hall was very long, and the gallery at the end loomed in a sort of twilight that was further deepened by the shadows of the flags overhead. But its benches afforded excellent sitting-out places, where strong light was not always an essential to happiness, and no one dreamed of finding fault. At first he danced cautiously, but by degrees the spirit of the time and place relieved his depression and helped him to forget. He had probably exaggerated the importance of his malady. Lots of other fellows, even as young as he was, had weak hearts and thought nothing of it. All the time, however, there was an undercurrent of sadness and disappointment not to be denied. Something had gone out of life. A note of darkness had crept in. He found his partners dull, and they no doubt found him still duller. Yet this dance, with nothing apparently to distinguish it from 100 others, stood out in all his experience with an indelible red mark against it. It is a common trick of nature, and a profoundly significant one, that just when despair is deepest, she waves a wand before the weary eyes and does her best to waken an impossible hope. Her idea, presumably, being to keep her victim going actively to the very end of the chapter, lest through indifference he should lose something of the lesson she wishes to teach. Thus it was that, midway in the dance, Brown's listless glance fell upon a certain girl whose appearance instantly galvanized him into a state of keenest possible desire. A flash of white light entered his heart and set him all on fire to know her. She attracted him tremendously. She was dressed in pale green and always danced with the same man, a man about his own height and coloring, whose face, however, he never could properly see. They sat out together much of the time, always in the gallery where the shadows were deepest. The girl's face he saw clearly, and there was something about her that simply lifted him bodily out of himself and sent strange thrills of delight coursing over him like shocks of electricity. Several times their eyes met, and when this happened, he could not tear his glance away. She fascinated him, and all the forces in his being merged into a single desire to be with her, to dance with her, speak with her, and to know her name. Especially he wondered who the man was she so favored. He reminded him so oddly of himself. No one knows precisely what he himself looks like, but this tall, dark figure, whose face he could never contrive to see, started the strange thought in him that it was his own double. In vain he sought to compass an introduction to this girl. No one seemed to know her. Her dress, her hair, and a certain wondrous slim grace made him think of a young tree waving in the wind, of ivy leaves, of something that belonged to the life of the woods rather than to ordinary humanity. She possessed him, filling his thoughts with wild woodland dreams. Once, too, he was certain when their eyes met that she smiled at him, and the call was so well-nigh irresistible that he almost dropped his partner's arm to run after her. But it seemed impossible to obtain an introduction from anyone. "Do you know who that girl is over there?" he asked one of his partners while sitting out a square dance, half exhausted with his exertions. "The one up there in the gallery?" "In pink?" "No, the one in green, I mean." "Oh, next the wallflower lady in red?" "In the gallery, not under it," he explained impatiently. "I can't see up there. It's so dark," returned the girl, after a careful survey through glasses. "I don't think I see anyone at all." "It is rather dark," he remarked. "Why, do you know who she is?" she asked foolishly. He did not like to insist. It seemed so rude to his partner. But this sort of thing happened once or twice. Evidently no one knew this girl in green, or else he described her so inaccurately that the people he asked looked at someone else instead. "In that green sort of ivy-looking dress," he tried another. "With the rose in her hair and the red nose, or the one sitting out?" After that he gave it up, finally. His partners seemed to sniff a little when he asked. Evidently La Désirée was not a popular maiden. Soon after, too, she disappeared and he lost sight of her. Yet the thought that she might have gone home made his heart sink into a sort of horrible blackness. He lingered on much later than he intended, in the hope of getting an introduction, but at last, when he had filled all his engagements, or nearly all, he made up his mind to slip out and go home. It was already late, and he had to be in the office, that hateful office, punctually at 9 o'clock. He felt tired, awfully tired, more so than ever before at a dance. It was, of course, his weak heart. He still dawdled a little while, however, hoping for another glimpse of the sylph in green, hungering for a last look that he could carry home with him and perhaps mingle with his dreams. The mere thought of her filled him with pain and joy and a sort of rarefied delight he had never known before. But he could not wait forever, and it was already close upon 2 o'clock in the morning. His rooms were only a short distance down the street. He would light a cigarette and stroll home. No, he had forgotten for a moment, without a cigarette. The doctor had been very stern on that point. He was in the act of turning his back on the whirl of dancing figures when the flags at the far end of the room parted for an instant in the moving air, and his eye rested upon the gallery just visible among the shadows. A great pain ran swiftly through his heart as he looked. There were only two figures seated there, the tall dark man, who was his double, and the ivy girl in green. She was looking straight at him down the length of the room, and even at that distance he could see that she smiled. He stopped short. The flags waved back again and hid the picture, but on the instant he made up his mind to act. There, among all this dreary crowd of dancing dolls, was someone he really wanted to know, to speak with, to touch, someone who drew him beyond all he had ever known and made his soul cry aloud. The room was filled with automatic lay figures, but here was someone alive. He must know her. It was impossible to go home without speech, utterly impossible. A fresh stab of pain, worse than the first, gave him momentary pause. He leaned against the wall for an instant, just under the clock, where the hands pointed to 2, waiting for the swooning blackness to go. Then he passed on, disregarding it utterly. It supplied him, in truth, with the extra little impetus he needed to set the will into vigorous action, for it reminded him forcibly of what might happen. His time might be short. He had known few enough of the good things of life. He would seize what he could. He had no introduction, but to the devil with the conventions. The risk was nothing. to meet her eyes at close quarters, to hear her voice, to know something of the perfume of that hair and dress. What was the risk of a snub compared to that? He slid down the side of the long room, dodging the dancers as best he could. The tall man, he noted, had left the gallery, but the girl sat on alone. He made his way quickly up the wooden steps, light as air, trembling with anticipation. His heart beat like a quick padded hammer, and the blood played a tambourine in his ears. It was odd he did not meet the tall man on the stairs, but doubtless there was another exit from the gallery that he had not observed. He topped the stairs and turned the corner. By Jove, she was still there, a few feet in front of him, sitting with her arms upon the railing, peering down upon the dancers below. His eyes swam for a moment, and something clutched at the very roots of his being. But he did not hesitate. He went up quite close past the empty seats, meaning to ask naturally and simply if he might beg for the pleasure of a dance. Then, when he was within a few feet of her side, the girl suddenly turned and faced him, and the words died away on his lips. They seemed absolutely foolish and inadequate. "Yes, I am ready," she said quietly, looking straight into his eyes. "But what a long time you were in coming. Was it such a great effort to leave?" The form of the question struck him as odd, but he was too happy to pause. He became transfigured with joy. The sound of her voice instantly drowned all the clatter of the ballroom, and seemed to him the only thing in the whole world. It did not break on the consonants like most human speech. It flowed smoothly. It was the sound of wind among branches, of water running over pebbles. It swept into him and caught him away, so that for a moment he saw his beloved woods and hills and seas. The stars were somewhere in it, too, and the murmur of the plains. By the gods! Here was a girl he could speak with in the words of silence. She stretched every string in his soul and then played on them. His spirit expanded with life and happiness. She would listen gladly to all that concerned him. To her he could talk openly about his poor broken heart, for she would sympathize. Indeed, it was all he could do to prevent himself running forward at once with his arms outstretched to take her. There was a perfume of earth and woods about her. "Oh, I am so awfully glad," he began lamely, his eyes on her face. Then, remembering something of earthly manners, he added, "My name, is..." Something unusual, something indescribable in her gesture stopped him. She had moved to give him space at her side. "Your name?" she laughed, drawing her green skirts with a soft rustle like leaves along the bench to make room. "But you need no name now, you know." Oh, the wonder of it! She understood him. He sat down with a feeling that he had been flying in a free wind and was resting among the tops of trees. The room faded out temporarily. "But my name, if you like to know, is Isidie," she said, still smiling. "Miss Isidie," he stammered, making another attempt at the forms of worldly politeness. "Not Miss Isidie," she laughed aloud merrily. It surely was the sound of wind in poplars. "Isidie is my first name, so if you call me anything, you must call me that." The name was pure music in his ears, but though he blundered about in his memory to find his own, it had utterly vanished. For the life of him, he could not recollect what his friends called him. He stared a moment, vaguely wondering, almost beside himself with delight. No other girls he had known. Ye heavens above, there were no longer any other girls. He had never known any other girl than this one. Here was his universe, framed in a green dress, with a voice of sea and wind, eyes like the sun, and movements of bending grasses. All else was mere shadow and fantasy. For the first time in his existence he was alive, and knew that he was alive. "I was sure you would come to me," she was saying. "You couldn't help yourself." Her eyes were always on his face. "I was afraid at first. But your thoughts," she interrupted softly, "your thoughts were up here with me all the time." "You knew that," he cried, delighted. "I felt them," she replied simply. "They, you, kept me company, for I have been alone here all the evening. I know no one else here yet." Her words amazed him. He was just going to ask who the tall, dark man was when he saw that she was rising to her feet and that she wanted to dance. "But my heart," he stammered. "It won't hurt your poor heart to dance with me, you know," she laughed. "You may trust me. I shall know how to take care of it." Brown felt simply ecstatic. It was too wonderful to be true. It was impossible. This meeting in London, at an ordinary dull dance in the 20th century. He would wake up presently from a dream of silver and gold. Yet he felt even then that she was drawing his arm about her waist for the dance, and with that first magical touch he almost lost consciousness and passed with her into a state of pure spirit. It puzzled him for a moment how they reached the floor so quickly and found themselves among the whirling couples. He had no recollection of coming down the stairs. But meanwhile he was dancing on wings, and the girl in green beside him seemed to fly too, and as he pressed her to his heart, he found it impossible to think of anything else in the world but that. That and his astounding happiness. And the music was within them rather than without. Indeed, they seemed to make their own music out of their swift, whirling movements, for it never ceased, and he never grew tired. His heart had ceased to pain him. Other curious things happened, too, but he hardly noticed them, or rather, they no longer seemed strange. In that crowded ballroom, they never once touched other people. His partner required no steering. She made no sound. Then suddenly he realized that his own feet made no sound either. They skimmed the floor with noiseless feet like spirits dancing. No one else appeared to take the least notice of them. Most of the faces seemed, indeed, strange to him now, as though he had not seen them before. But once or twice he could have sworn that he passed couples who were dancing almost as happily and lightly as themselves, couples he had known in past years, couples who were dead. Gradually, the room emptied of its original comers, and others filled their places, silently, with airy, graceful movements and happy faces, till the whole floor at length was covered with the soundless feet and whirling forms of those who had already left the world. And as the artificial light faded away, there came in its place a soft white light that filled the room with beauty and made all the faces look radiant. And once, as they skimmed past a mirror, he saw that the girl beside him was not there, that he seemed to be dancing alone, clasping no one. Yet when he glanced down, there was her magical face at his shoulder, and he felt her little form pressing up against him. Such dancing, too, he had never even dreamed about, for it was like swinging with the treetops in the winds. Then they danced farther out, ever swifter and swifter, past the shadows beneath the gallery, under the motionless hanging flags, and out into the night. The walls were behind them. They were off their feet, and the wind was in their hair. They were rising, rising, rising towards the stars. He felt the cool air of the open sky on his cheeks, and when he looked down, as they cleared the summit of the dark-lying hills, he saw that Isidy had melted away into himself, and they had become one being. And he knew then that his heart would never pain him again on earth, or cause him to fear for any of his beloved dreams. But the manager of the hateful office only knew 2 days later why Brown had not turned up to his desk, nor sent any word to explain his absence. He read it in the paper, how he had dropped down dead at a dance, suddenly stricken by heart disease. It happened just before 2 o'clock in the morning. "Well," thought the manager, "he's no loss to us anyhow. He had no real business instincts. Smith will do his work much better, and for less money, too."
Thank you.
God, I wish I knew what those numbers meant.
Yeah, probably if we knew, we would wouldn't be sitting here.
Yeah, it would have been kind of nice to go like that, though, at a dance.
Yeah, with a pretty lady.
It would a pretty perfect, lady. With perfect a perfect lady, nonetheless.
Nonetheless.
And here just, I am, stuck with you.
Well, but could be worse. You could have been all alone.
True.
Well, that wouldn't actually not be so bad either.
No, I would just do the same.
Not with all the books you got.
Yeah, exactly. I know. Oh, well. Maybe it isn't all that bad after all.
No, but this piece is, tries to explain death, but it wasn't really horror.
No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't.
Doesn't suit a horror program.
No, it doesn't, but still, it's I think it's fitting in the circumstances with the world going to pots around us.
Yeah, literally, yeah. I hear it.
Yeah, with the bombs and everything.
Yeah. I wonder if anyone listens to us, actually.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe all the radios got blown up.
Yeah. Hard to know when the technician is dead.
Yeah. I hope they don't blow up our stuff. No, the roof. I mean, that would be horrible. That would be expensive.
Yeah.
God damn, I used most of my life savings on that.
But do we have any other literature here?
Yeah, we do. If you take not that shelf, that one, yes, that one, that one, yeah, that there,
yeah,
yep, yeah, that one. Was it a dream by some French dude, Guy de Maupassant?
Do we like him?
He died at the age of 42. Yes,
yeah,
we like him.
Yeah, we like him.
It was French though, but
but 42 and.
Oh my, he was a prodigy of Flaubert. That's quite cool.
Yeah, and actually, when I think of it, one of his works actually were an inspiration for Lovecraft, The Call of Cthulhu.
That's cool.
And that's serious. That's what we love. We love
we
that
like
one.
That. And he has also an epitaph about life, his own life. He wrote it himself. I coveted everything and taken pleasure in nothing.
Okay, I love him now.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah. But what is this piece?
Oh, it's about life and the illusions we have about our loved ones, or especially the dead, actually.
Yeah.
Which is a bit too fitting here right now, but
yeah, quite.
Yeah.
Should we just start it?
Yeah, I think we should.
Was it a dream by Guy de Maupassant? I had loved her madly. Why does one love? Why does one love? How queer it is to see only one being in the world, to have only one thought in one's mind, only one desire in the heart, and only one name on the lips, a name which comes up continually, rising like the water in a spring, from the depths of the soul to the lips, a name which one repeats over and over again, which one whispers ceaselessly everywhere like a prayer. I am going to tell you our story, for love only has one, which is always the same. I met her and loved her, that is all. And for a whole year I have lived on her tenderness, on her caresses, in her arms, in her dresses, on her words, so completely wrapped up, bound, and absorbed in everything which came from her, that I no longer cared whether it was day or night, or whether I was dead or alive, on this old earth of ours. And then she died. How? I do not know. I no longer know anything. But one evening she came home wet, for it was raining heavily, and the next day she coughed, and she coughed for about a week, and took to her bed. What happened, I do not remember now, but doctors came, wrote, and went away. Medicines were brought, and some women made her drink them. Her hands were hot, her forehead was burning, and her eyes bright and sad. When I spoke to her, she answered me, but I do not remember what we said. I have forgotten everything, everything, everything. She died, and I very well remember her slight, feeble sigh. The nurse said, "Ah," and I understood. I knew nothing more, nothing. I saw a priest who said, "Your mistress?" And it seemed to me as if he were insulting her. As she was dead, nobody had the right to say that any longer, and I turned him out. Another came who was very kind and tender, and I shed tears when he spoke to me about her. They consulted me about the funeral, but I do not remember anything that they said, though I recollected the coffin and the sound of the hammer when they nailed her down in it. Oh, God, God. She was buried, she, in that hole. Some people came, female friends. I made my escape and ran away. I ran and then walked through the streets, went home, and the next day started on a journey. Yesterday I returned to Paris, and when I saw my room again, our room, our bed, our furniture, everything that remains of the life of a human being after death, I was seized by such a violent attack of fresh grief that I felt like opening the window and throwing myself out into the street. I could not remain any longer among these things, between these walls which had enclosed and sheltered her, which retained 1,000 atoms of her skin and of her breath, in their imperceptible crevices. I took up my hat to make my escape, and just as I reached the door I passed the large glass in the hall, which she had put there so that she might look at herself every day from head to foot as she went out, to see if her toilette looked well, and was correct and pretty, from her little boots to her bonnet. I stopped short in front of that looking-glass in which she had so often been reflected, so often, that it must have retained her reflection. I was standing there, trembling, with my eyes fixed on the glass, on that flat, profound, empty glass which had contained her entirely and had possessed her as much as I, as my passionate looks had. I felt as if I loved that glass. I touched it. It was cold. Oh, the recollection! Sorrowful mirror, burning mirror, horrible mirror, to make men suffer such torments. Happy is the man whose heart forgets everything that it has contained, everything that has passed before it, everything that has looked at itself in it, or has been reflected in its affection, in its love. How I suffer! I went out without knowing it, without wishing it, and toward the cemetery. I found her simple grave, a white marble cross, with these few words: "She loved, was loved, and died." She is there below, decayed. How horrible! I sobbed with my forehead on the ground, and I stopped there for a long time, a long time. Then I saw that it was getting dark, and a strange, mad wish, the wish of a despairing lover, seized me. I wished to pass the night, the last night, in weeping on her grave. But I should be seen and driven out. How was I to manage? I was cunning and got up and began to roam about in that city of the dead. I walked and walked. How small this city is in comparison with the other, the city in which we live. And yet, how much more numerous the dead are than the living. We want high houses, wide streets, and much room for the four generations who see the daylight at the same time, drink water from the spring and wine from the vines, and eat bread from the plains. And for all the generations of the dead, for all that ladder of humanity that has descended down to us, there is scarcely anything, scarcely anything. The earth takes them back and oblivion effaces them. Adieu. At the end of the cemetery, I suddenly perceived that I was in its oldest part, where those who had been dead a long time are mingling with the soil, where the crosses themselves are decayed, where possibly newcomers will be put tomorrow. It is full of untended roses, of strong and dark cypress trees, a sad and beautiful garden nourished on human flesh. I was alone, perfectly alone. So I crouched in a green tree and hid myself there completely amid the thick and somber branches. I waited, clinging to the stem, like a shipwrecked man does to a plank. When it was quite dark, I left my refuge and began to walk softly, slowly, inaudibly through that ground full of dead people. I wandered about for a long time, but could not find her tomb again. I went on with extended arms, knocking against the tombs with my hands, my feet, my knees, my chest, even with my head, without being able to find her. I groped about like a blind man finding his way. I felt the stones, the crosses, the iron railings, the metal wreaths, and the wreaths of faded flowers. I read the names with my fingers by passing them over the letters. What a night, what a night. I could not find her again. There was no moon. What a night. I was frightened, horribly frightened in these narrow paths between two rows of graves. Graves, 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 nothing but graves. On my right, on my left, in front of me, around me, everywhere there were graves. I sat down on one of them, for I could not walk any longer. My knees were so weak. I could hear my heart beat, and I heard something else as well. What? A confused, nameless noise. Was the noise in my head, in the impenetrable night, or beneath the mysterious earth, the earth sown with human corpses? I looked all round me, but I cannot say how long I remained there. I was paralyzed with terror, cold with fright, ready to shout out, ready to die. Suddenly it seemed to me that the slab of marble on which I was sitting was moving. Certainly it was moving, as if it were being raised. With a bound I sprang onto the neighboring tomb, and I saw, yes, I distinctly saw the stone which I had just quitted rise upright. Then the dead person appeared, a naked skeleton, pushing the stone back with its bent back. I saw it quite clearly, although the night was so dark. On the cross I could read, "Here lies Jacques Olivant, who died at the age of 51. He loved his family, was kind and honorable, and died in the grace of the Lord." The dead man also read what was inscribed on his tombstone. Then he picked up a stone off the path, a little pointed stone, and began to scrape the letters carefully. He slowly effaced them, and with the hollows of his eyes he looked at the places where they had been engraved. Then, with the tip of the bone that had been his forefinger, he wrote in luminous letters, like those lines which boys trace on walls with the tip of a lucifer match. "Here reposes Jacques Olivant, who died at the age of 51. He hastened his father's death by his unkindness, as he wished to inherit his fortune. He tortured his wife, tormented his children, deceived his neighbors, robbed everyone he could, and died wretched." When he had finished writing, the dead man stood motionless, looking at his work. On turning round, I saw that all the graves were open, that all the dead bodies had emerged from them, and that all had effaced the lies inscribed on the gravestones by their relations, substituting the truth instead. And I saw that all had been the tormentors of their neighbors, malicious, dishonest, hypocrites, liars, rogues, calumniators, envious, that they had stolen, deceived, performed every disgraceful, every abominable action. These good fathers, these faithful wives, these devoted sons, these chaste daughters, these honest tradesmen, these men and women who were called irreproachable, they were all writing at the same time, on the threshold of their eternal abode, the truth, the terrible and the holy truth of which everybody was ignorant, or pretended to be ignorant, while they were alive. I thought that she also must have written something on her tombstone, and now running without any fear among the half-open coffins, among the corpses and skeletons, I went toward her, sure that I should find her immediately. I recognized her at once, without seeing her face, which was covered by the winding sheet, and on the marble cross, where shortly before I had read, "She loved, was loved, and died," I now saw, having gone out in the rain one day, in order to deceive her lover, she caught cold and died. It appears that they found me at daybreak, lying on the grave unconscious.
Thank you.
Adam Gordon played. He is coming. I actually have some music down there as well.
Yeah, of course. Remarkable. Yeah, of course we do.
Oh, bloody bombs! If this stands after the whoever they are, do you know who they are?
No, actually don't.
Oh, there you go.
I thought you know. So
I thought you knew.
No.
Okay.
You can't trust anyone, can you?
No, we can't. No. Well, if his things still stand after rubble, you might check things out at LibriVox.com or something.
Org, I think.
I don't know. Yeah. Vision is dead, so we don't know. Anyhow, it's released under the Creative Commons. Not that it matters, now the war is on. But if you want to hear more of us, you can try to tune in January, and maybe, if the house still stands, we will be broadcasting.
Yeah, and if not, they'll send flowers.
Send flowers, we'll need them.
Well, yeah. We won't, but there are no money left after us to buy flowers for our graves, because we have used them all on books.
Graves will need them.
I love it. Yeah, yeah, we perhaps need graves.
Yeah, perhaps we need graves.
Well.
Oh, well. That's life for you. So, thanks to LibriVox. It was fun while it lasted.
Yeah.
Or something like that. Now I think we'll hear some more music to lighten up the atmosphere. We'll hear Silvergate with, intro. And good night and all that things.
Yeah, and goodbye.
Goodbye and good luck.